From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now!, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We're breaking with convention.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination.
Before a thunderous crowd of 20,000, Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. If she wins, she'll become the first woman, the first black woman, and the first person of South Asian descent to be elected U.S. president. We'll get response and look at how Shirley Chisholm and Fannie Lou Hamer helped pave the way for this historic moment. Harris accepted the nomination after a four-day convention where her campaign refused to allow a Palestinian American to take the stage despite repeated demands by uncommitted delegates.
Here is the scandal, my friends. Here is the scandal. The scandal is that there are forces within Democratic Party leadership who do not want us to talk about Palestinian human rights. But that's not sustainable. This is a watershed moment.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday night here in Chicago. Harris is the first black woman and person of South Asian descent to be nominated for president by a major party. Before a thunderous crowd of 20,000, Harris, who was California's top prosecutor before becoming a senator, then vice president, laid out her case against Donald Trump.
Just imagine Donald Trump with no guardrails. And how he would use the immense powers of the presidency of the United States. Not to improve your life, not to strengthen our national security, but to serve the only client he has ever had, himself.
During her speech, Kamala Harris reiterated her support for Israel while also calling for its U.S.-backed war on Gaza to end.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
Protests continued Thursday with thousands of people taking to Chicago's streets for the march on the DNC. Protesters rallied into the night as Kamala Harris accepted the Democratic presidential nomination on the convention stage. Demonstrators had planned to march toward the convention site, but were blocked by hundreds of police and riot gear who forced the march to disperse. Democracy Now! Was there, asking protesters what their message was for Vice President Harris.
I am asking her to look into her humanity and to look at photos like this and recognize that this is what happens every day, hundreds of times a day, for decades, and in particular the last 10 months.
The protester held up a photo on her cell phone of a Palestinian child with burn wounds on their face. Meanwhile, delegates from the uncommitted movement locked arms and walked inside the DNC halls wearing Palestinian keffiyehs one day after the DNC refused to allow a Palestinian American speaker to take the main stage. Uncommitted delegates circled the halls of the United Center arm in arm until eventually they were able to take their seats on the convention floor in their delegations after they were initially denied. The powerful United Auto Workers Union is the latest group to condemn the exclusion of Palestinian American voices from the DNC, saying in a statement, quote, "If we want the war in Gaza to end, we can't put our heads in the sand or ignore the voices of the Palestinian Americans and the Democratic Party." In Gaza, the UN says it'll begin vaccinating children against polio by the end of the month amidst fears of a massive outbreak. This comes as Israeli attacks continue to kill besieged Gazans as soldiers ramp up operations in Deir al-Bala in central Gaza and Khan Yunis in the south. Israeli negotiators have returned from more ceasefire talks in Cairo as Israel continues to rebuff Hamas's demand for Israel's complete withdrawal from Gaza. On Thursday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, told the U.N. Security Council a ceasefire and hostage deal is, quote, now in sight. Riyad Mansour, Palestine's U.N. envoy, also addressed the Security Council Thursday.
Stop the bleeding in Gaza. Impose an immediate ceasefire. Stop the suffering. Protect our children and all our civilians as international law and our collective humanity demand. End this genocide. End it now.
Israel has killed over 40,200 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th and injured over 93,000, though those official tallies are certainly far lower than the true toll. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed three Palestinians during an attack Thursday on the Tul Karm refugee camp, where the Israeli military has been conducting near-daily raids. The repeated Israeli assaults have been described as collective punishment intended to terrorize and dispossess the local population. This is a homeowner in Tul Karm whose house was destroyed during the raid.
We are like other people. They say there is a raid and a military operation, so we flee the house because they usually attack this neighborhood. We went to my brother's house. While at my brother's home, we saw on social media that our house was blown up.
In other news from the occupied West Bank, the Norwegian Refugee Council is calling on the international community to take meaningful action after noting Israeli settler violence has triggered the largest forcible transfer since October 7th. The NRC said the ongoing attacks are, quote, occurring in broad daylight under the watching eyes and the protective force of the Israeli military and highlight the unlawfulness of Israel's presence in the West Bank as recently ruled by the International Court of Justice, unquote. The World Food Program says a small convoy of humanitarian aid trucks has entered Sudan, offering a slight respite to thousands of displaced people facing famine in western Darfur's Karenik region. The UN convoy comes after the Sudanese military agreed to reopen portions of Sudan's border with Chad. The Sudanese army had previously allowed only a trickle of aid into Sudan, claiming the rival rapid support forces were using the routes for smuggling weapons. Back in the United States, voters in Arkansas will not be weighing in on a ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution. After Arkansas's Supreme Court rejected a grassroots ballot initiative over a technicality on how signatures were registered. Abortions are currently banned in Arkansas with limited exceptions for severe medical emergencies. The group that gathered the signatures, Arkansans for Limited Government, vowed to keep fighting, saying, quote, "This effort has generated a wave of fiercely engaged Arkansas women. We're outraged, we will not back down, and we will remember this in November," they said. The U.S. Supreme Court sided with Arizona Republicans Thursday as it ordered the partial and temporary reinstatement of an Arizona law requiring proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote. The law was first enacted in 2022, triggering legal challenges by the Biden administration and voting rights groups. But the Supreme Court blocked Arizona from putting into effect another part of that law, which could have prohibited tens of thousands of voters who are already registered from participating in the presidential election without proving their U.S. citizenship. And the National Labor Relations Board ruled Thursday Amazon must recognize and bargain with its unionized delivery workers in Palmdale, California, rejecting Amazon's claims that it is not their main employer since the workers are subcontracted through another company. Delivery workers with the Teamsters Union celebrated the ruling.
Amazon cannot dodge any responsibility for these low wages anymore. For the safety. Like, it's so dangerous to work for this company. They can't hide that anymore. It's a lot easier for us now. Why? Because now you have to bargain with us. You have to recognize your drivers as union members if they want to organize. Why? Because it's time. It's the worker power that we came up with that we're fighting and using to obviously get what we need. If you are an Amazon driver, an Amazon worker, that's been sitting on the fence, reach out to us. Send us a DM, fill out a form, because it is that time.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We are breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN TV here in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday night here in Chicago. Harris is the first black woman and person of South Asian descent to be nominated for the president by a major party. Her nomination came just over a month after President Biden dropped out of the race. Before a thunderous crowd at the United Center, Harris laid out her case against Donald Trump.
Fellow Americans, this election is not only the most important of our lives, it is one of the most important in the life of our nation. In many ways, Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious. Consider not only the chaos and calamity when he was in office, but also the gravity of what has happened since he lost the last election. Donald Trump tried to throw away your votes. When he failed, he sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol, where they assaulted law enforcement officers. When politicians in his own party begged him to call off the mob and send help, he did the opposite. He fanned the flames. And now, for an entirely different set of crimes, he was found guilty of fraud by a jury of everyday Americans, and separately found liable for committing sexual abuse. And consider what he intends to do if we give him power again. Consider his explicit intent to set free violent extremists who assaulted those law enforcement officers at the Capitol. His explicit intent to jail journalists, political opponents, and anyone he sees as the enemy. His explicit intent to deploy our active duty military against our own citizens. Consider the power he will have have, especially after the United States Supreme Court just ruled that he would be immune from criminal prosecution. Just imagine Donald Trump with no guardrails. And how he would use the immense powers of the presidency of the United States. Not to improve your life, not to strengthen our national security, but to serve the only client he has ever had, himself. And we know what a second Trump term would look like. It's all laid out in Project 2025, written by his closest advisors, and its sum total is to pull our country back to the past. But America, we are not going back. To when he tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, when insurance companies could deny people with pre-existing conditions. We are not going to let him eliminate the Department of Education that funds our public schools.
Kamala Harris speaking on Thursday night at the Democratic National Convention. We'll get response to her acceptance speech when we come back with Barbara Ransby, historian, author, and activist. Stay with us. Franklin featuring Blues Brothers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. We are breaking with convention. We're here in Chicago for the last day of our five-day expanded two-hour broadcast from the Democratic National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we continue our coverage of Vice President Kamala Harris, who formally accepted the Democratic presidential nomination on Thursday night here in Chicago. If Harris wins in November, she will become the first black woman and person of South Asian descent to be nominated for president by a major party.
We are joined now by historian, author, and activist Barbara Ransby. She's a professor of Black Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Ransby's latest book is Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Professor Ransby. Well, it was a historic night in many ways. You have Vice President Harris accepting the presidential nomination before 20,000 people. Many of the women, though she wasn't, many of the women were dressed in white to honor the original suffragists. Can you talk about the significance of this moment and what Vice President Harris did and didn't say?
What she did and didn't say. Thanks for having me, Amy, and welcome to Chicago. don't have to say welcome to Juan because he's here with us. But yeah, I mean, it's a historic moment in a lot of ways. Certainly, it breaks a barrier. I never thought I would see a black woman nominated. But, you know, I want to speak to the historic significance, but I also want to talk about the contradictions, right? Kamala Harris, unlike others who have, you know, fought for inclusion in the Democratic Party at the convention, you know, isn't coming out of the same kind of movement. She has ties to the civil rights movement through her mother, and she also participated in the anti-apartheid movement. But really, you know, I think a lot of what I appreciate about this generation of activists is the de-emphasis on representation and the emphasis on politics and the emphasis on where do you stand on issues. And if we think about a tradition of black women in politics, including in the Democratic Party, right, it has been pushing the conscience of the Democratic Party toward a radical inclusivity, toward some of the most oppressed sectors of our community and all communities. And so, yes, it is significant in terms of representation, but again, at a time when representation is limited. We have a multiracial right-wing movement, by the way. So representation is not the goal. And, you know, I just want to de-emphasize in some ways. I mean, of course, we can talk about, you know, a larger political lineage, which she is connected to. But I know, you know, I hope, I think we're going to talk about Fannie Lou Hamer and others. But I think of someone like Abbas Alawi as much more in the tradition of Fannie Lou Hamer than a Kamala Harris. So, yes, it breaks barriers. Yes, you know, it is a historic moment in a certain sense, but we have to also talk about the gravity of this moment and the politics that Kamala Harris brings with her. So that is my historian's view and my activist view.
And your response to the DNC's decision to not allow a Palestinian-American voice on the stage?
Disgraceful. Absolutely disgraceful. I mean, and it was such a small ask. You know, we're witnessing genocide in Gaza right now, and many of our hearts are breaking. Certainly our Palestinian friends and colleagues here who've lost dozens of family members, people you've had on your show who tell harrowing stories, the physicians who've gone there and seen the devastation of children, hospitals bombed, et cetera. So, you know, a minimum of decency would have been to allow for a Palestinian voice on that stage.
And I'm wondering, the whole week, for those of us who remember the old Democratic conventions, the first convention that I covered...
Yeah, you were raising trouble in 68, I hear.
Right, but the first one I actually covered inside was in 1984.
Okay.
And what has struck me about this convention and the last several is the level of mass, of choreography of mass spectacle.
Yes.
There are no, back in the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s, individual delegates could hold up their own signs. You know, the cameras would show a dissent in the audience. Now we're talking about a Democratic Party where every single banner is controlled and decided by the organizers of the convention, and everyone like sheep get up and hold the same signs at the appropriate times that they've been told to do it. And so you really have no dissent visible at all within a supposedly Democratic Party.
Interestingly, on the floor, it was the Minnesota delegation, and that's an interesting delegation. They had 10 uncommitted people who would not commit to Will President Biden at the time when voting in the primary. And they held up the names of Palestinians who had died in Gaza. And immediately, the other delegates in the Minnesota delegation, well prepared, held up USA signs that covered all of those signs.
Yeah, I missed that.
And then you had the unfurling of the banner earlier in the week. This was in the Florida delegation by a Florida delegate, a Connecticut delegate, and a delegate from Michigan that said, "Stop arming Israel." And they immediately put up signs, placards that said, "We love Joe." It was Monday night when Joe Biden was speaking. Yeah. And immediately, the some of the runners for that Florida delegation started handing out dozens of placards. And so they had more and more to cover the banner because that was particularly large.
Concealing and containing protest and this sort of cosmetic appearance of unity when there was dissent in that room, not just the uncommitted delegates, but others. But it has a carnivalesque feel to it. And the real conversations and the real passions and debates were happening outside.
Well, let's stay inside for a minute.
Okay.
Let's go to Kamala Harris addressing the issue of Israel-Palestine and Israel's war on Gaza.
With respect to the war in Gaza, President Biden and I are working around the clock because now is the time to get a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done. Stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself, because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7, including unspeakable sexual violence and the massacre of young people at a music festival. At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking. President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination. To defend our forces and our interests against Iran and Iran-backed terrorists.
That's Vice President Kamala Harris in her acceptance speech for the Democratic nomination for president. Speaking here in Chicago at the United Center, Professor Ransby, your response.
Well, I was glad to hear her mention the suffering of the Palestinian people, but of course it didn't ring true. It rang a little bit hollow because the Biden administration could stop much of that suffering, you know, by not sending 2,000-pound bombs and $3 billion a year to the Israeli government. So, you know, it would have been backed up by action if it would have been backed up by allowing a Palestinian speaker to speak in their own terms. That part would have resonated. But of course, talking about Israel's right to defense disguises the fact that this is an offensive war, offensive on every level that word means something, right? And the United States is facilitating it. And the, you know, 40,000 Palestinian lives. I mean, you all, you know, absorb these numbers every day in your reports, but it was not enough. It was the wrong message. And, you know, a throwaway line about Palestinian suffering does not get it.
So let's go to what wouldn't have been a throwaway line.
Okay.
And this is what the uncommitted delegates attempted to get all week. You have Harris accepting the Democratic nomination Thursday night after a four-day convention where the Harris campaign refused to allow a Palestinian American to take the stage. There were private negotiations that were going on throughout the week. But at a news conference on Thursday, delegates with the Uncommitted Movement said the Democratic National Committee told them it was the Harris campaign that they denied their request to have a Palestinian American speak. After receiving the news on Wednesday, many of the delegates and their allies staged a sit-in and spent the night on the sidewalk just outside the United Center.
In state Democratic primaries earlier this year to call for an end to the Biden administration's backing of Israel in its assault on Gaza and for an arms embargo. The Uncommitted National Movement called on Harris to come to Michigan, where the Uncommitted Movement was launched, to meet with them and discuss U.S. policy on Israel-Palestine by September 15th.
Among those who spoke at the press conference yesterday was Rua Rahman, a Palestinian-American who is a Georgia state representative in the Georgia legislature. She was among a list of speakers offered by the Uncommitted Movement that the Harris campaign refused to allow on stage. In her remarks, she read out the speech that she would have given at the convention had the convention allowed a Palestinian-American on stage. This is Rua Rahman.
So what I'm about to read to you is frankly very sanitized. It was meant to have an opportunity to represent a Palestinian voice. But I'm incredibly dismayed because we came here to offer a gift. We came here to offer an opportunity to bridge the gap between our party and our voters. Because when you looked around that convention, everybody, I mean, you literally looked around, so many people wearing their pins, their kufiyas, their flags. It's very unfortunate. My name is Rua Rahman, and I'm honored to be the first Palestinian elected to public office in the great state of Georgia.
That's right.
And the first Palestinian to ever speak at the Democratic National Convention. My story begins in a small village near Jerusalem called Suba, where my dad's family is from. My mom's roots trace back to Al-Khalil, or Hebron. My parents, born in Jordan, brought us to Georgia when I was 8, where I now live with my wonderful husband and our sweet pets. Growing up, my grandfather and I shared a special bond. He was my partner in chief. Whether it was sneaking me sweets from a bodega, or slipping me a 20 into my pocket with that familiar wink and a smile. He was my rock, but he passed away a few years ago, never seeing Suba or any part of Palestine again. Not a day goes by that I don't miss him. This past year has been especially hard as we've been moral witnesses to the massacres in Gaza. I've thought of him, wondering if this was the pain he knew too well. When we watch Palestinians displaced from one end of the Gaza Strip to the other, I wanted to ask him, how did he find the strength to walk all of those miles decades ago and leave everything behind? But in this pain, I've also witnessed something profound. A beautiful, multi-faith, multi-racial, and multi-generational coalition rising from despair within our Democratic Party. For 320 days, we've stood together demanding to enforce our laws on friend and foe alike to reach a ceasefire and the killing of Palestinians, free all the Israeli and Palestinian hostages, and to begin the difficult work of building a path to collective peace and safety. That's why we are here, members of this Democratic Party committed to equal rights and dignity for all. What we do here echoes around the world. They'll say this is how it's always been, that nothing can change. But remember, Fannie Lou Hamer shunned for her courage, yet she paved the way for an integrated Democratic Party. Her legacy lives on, and it's her example we follow. But we can't do it alone. This historic moment is full of promise, but only if we stand together. Our party's greatest strength has always been our ability to unite. Some see that as a weakness, but it's time we flex that strength. Let's commit to each other, to electing Vice President Harris and defeating Donald Trump, who uses my identity as a Palestinian as a slur. Let's fight for the policies long overdue, from restoring access to abortions, to ensuring a living wage, to demanding an end to reckless war and a ceasefire in Gaza. To those who doubt us, to the cynics and the naysayers, I say yes, we can. Yes, we can be a Democratic Party that prioritizes funding our schools and hospitals, not for endless wars.
That's right.
That fights for an America that belongs to all of us, black, brown, and white, Jews and Palestinians, all of us, like my grandfather taught me, together.
That was Rua Rahman, a Palestinian American who is a Georgia state representative, reading the speech she would have given had the Harris campaign allowed a Palestinian American to speak on stage.
After holding a press conference outside and committee delegates locked arms and walked inside the convention hall wearing Palestinian keffiyehs.
What we're demonstrating is that in a party that stands for freedom, there should be space for freedom for Palestine. So we're taking up space as we walk a full lap of the halls of the United Center to stand for a free Palestine, to make sure that every person in this arena right now has to think about Palestine. The war has killed over 16,000 Palestinian children as the Israeli government uses bombs provided by the United States. We take up this space. We take this to the delegates head on, to our elected officials head on, with our message of peace, of freedom, of no more war, of no more violence, a future safe for Israelis and Palestinians alike, Jews and Muslims alike.
Hassan Safouri.
Do you feel that the other delegates in this convention see you?
I hope they do. I don't know that they have so far. I know that in the last couple of days, there have been a couple of moments where they have tried to block us. And when we did the roll call, there were delegates who stood up and took their signs, USA, USA, and blocked us so that the media couldn't see us. Now, that's not just having blinders on, that's putting blinders on. So we want to make sure that that doesn't happen anymore. I'm sure that the whole delegation, everybody here, is seeing us now.
We will win! We will win! I believe that we will win! I believe that we will win!
So that was the protest. That was the uncommitted delegates walking arm in arm inside the convention center through the halls before they took their seats in their various delegations.
Meanwhile, outside, thousands of protesters marched on the DNC calling for an end to USA to Israel. The protesters rallied into the night as Kamala Harris accepted the Democratic presidential nomination on the DNC stage. They had planned to march toward the convention site, but were blocked by hundreds of police in riot gear who forced the march to disperse.
Democracy Now!'s Maria Tarasena was in the streets speaking to protesters.
If you had the opportunity to deliver a message to Vice President Kamala Harris, what would you tell her?
I am asking her to look into her humanity and to look at photos like this and recognize that this is what happens every day, hundreds of times a day, for decades, and in particular the last 10 months. And our humanity, the Palestinian people's humanity, does not rely upon the humanity of others, meaning it does not need to be within that context, meaning I am sick of seeing the media only relay the inhumane conditions in Gaza within the context of October 7th, within the context of what is happening to Israelis. It just has to stop.
Could you describe the photo that you were showing us?
This is a child that has been burned. There's no anesthesia. There's no antibiotics. This child is suffering in filth and pain. And this is just one out of tens of thousands.
This didn't start on October 7th, and I don't think, and it's ahistorical to pretend that it did. You know, this has been an almost century-long liberation struggle. My partner is Palestinian, and everybody that knows a Palestinian knows their family's Nakba story. I know my partner's grandparents' Nakba story. They came from a town called Al-Lid in 48. And, you know, you can't erase a people off the face of a planet. Well, I'm a Chicano. My family's from Guadalajara, so I'm wearing a Mexican flag around my back and a kefir around my neck and a Sox hat on my head because I'm a Chicagoan. Ni de aquí ni de allá. But, you know, I don't know. I think that people in struggles recognize each other in this moment.
The message we want to give is that veterans, we understand what self-defense, we understand what war is. What we are witnessing, the footage coming out, is not self-defense. This is not war. This is a genocide. We have a duty as a country to follow international laws, to respect the Geneva Conventions, and we're not doing that right now by unconditionally supporting a country, a foreign country, who's committing a genocide.
Just a few of the thousands of people who marched through the streets of Chicago on Thursday night. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Maria Terracena and Hannah Elias. Coming up, we look at how Shirley Chisholm and Fannie Lou Hamer helped pave the way for Kamala Harris. Stay with us. By Sam and Dave, written by Isaac Hayes. The Hayes family has sued Donald Trump for copyright infringement for using the song in his campaign. They say since 2022, since telling him to stop, he's used it more than 120 times at various rallies and events. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We are breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up our 5 days here in Chicago covering the DNC.
As we continue our coverage of the Democratic National Convention, we turn now to look at the legacy of Shirley Chisholm. In 1968, she became the first black woman elected to Congress. 4 years later, in 1972, she became the first woman and the first African-American to seek a major party nomination. On Thursday night, the Reverend Al Sharpton spoke at the convention and talked briefly about her.
52 years ago, I was one of the youth directors in her campaign for president. And 52 years after she was told to sit down, I know she's watching us tonight as a black woman stands up to accept the nomination for president of the United States.
That was the Reverend Al Sharpton speaking at the Democratic National Convention this week. Shirley Chisholm now speaking in 1972. When she declared her presidential candidacy.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. I stand here now without endorsements from many big-name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop. I do not intend to offer to you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate of the people of America.
You. That was Chisholm in 7. That was Shirley Chisholm in 1972.
Well, we're still here with Barbara Ransby, historian, author, and activist, professor of Black Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Barbara, your thoughts about the legacy of Shirley Chisholm?
Yeah, I think about Shirley Chisholm a lot these days, and that wonderful slogan of her campaign, Unbought and Unbossed, right? She was an independent thinker. She was fierce. She came out of Brooklyn, as you said, and came from West Indian parents. And she had a tough road, you know, just in terms of representation. We were talking about before being the first Black woman in Congress. There's a scene, Shawa Lynch has a wonderful documentary film about Shirley Chisholm, and Shirley Chisholm recounts a Southern white senator who just couldn't get over her sitting across from him and them having the same job. And he said, "You know, Miss Chisholm, we both make 39.5. And she said, "I'm going to keep on making 39.5. You know, so she forced her way into spaces that, you know, she was not wanted because of racism and sexism. But inside the Democratic Party, when she ran in 1972, she got mocked. She got a lot of opposition, also from Black leaders, Black male leaders in particular. And she was somebody, I think, who I never met her. But, you know, from my study of Black women's history and from people who did know her, you know, she was a person of principle and resisting pragmatism that is so rampant in politics, right? So, you know, Black Panther Party supported her, and she supported them. And they were saying, "Well, why are you supporting this group of armed, you know, folks?" And she said, "Well, because they're fighting for, you know, poor Black people." So, so I think Shirley Chisholm really represents some of the best of folks working inside electoral politics, and wish we had more of that.
And what was the response to her running for president? How much pressure did she receive?
She received a lot of pressure to not run for president, and a lot of pushback from people who she felt, who she thought initially would support her. Again, you know, her appearance was mocked. Her, you know, she was sidelined in a lot of ways in larger Democratic and political and a Black political discourse. So she had a lot of pushback, being a woman and being Black.
And so talk about her campaign. And ultimately, obviously, she did not get the nomination. But when she decided to pull out, the pressure both in the overall community and also in the Black community, the response to Shirley Chisholm running for president.
Yeah. I think she was very close to Ron Dellums at that time. And so she went to the convention.
The congressman from California.
The congressman, late congressman from California, who was a very progressive force in Congress. It was a young activist at that time. And she went to the convention and, you know, realized she didn't have enough delegates and wouldn't have enough delegates and released her delegates in very tearful fashion. But you know, but then continue to be a voice and to be a presence in Democratic Party circles, but not just in Democratic Party circles. This is 1972, in movement circles. And I think talked about the need for a link between social movements and electoral politics, which is really what we have to remember in this moment.
Let's talk about Fannie Lou Hamer. Shirley Chisholm comes after Fannie Lou Hamer, the daughter of Mississippi sharecroppers who became involved in the civil rights movement. When she volunteered to attempt to register to vote in 1962, by then the 45-year-old mother lost her job, continuously risked her life over her civil rights activism. Despite this and a brutal beating, Hamer helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. We're going to go right now to a clip of Fannie Lou Hamer. This is 1964, addressing the Democratic National Convention, the Rules Committee, in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
So that's Fannie Lou Hamer. And Professor Ransby, we want you to tell us about what she was attempting to do and what the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was, this alternate delegation. But at the time, Lyndon Johnson was so outraged that the cameras were focused on this black woman at the Democratic National Convention that I think he held an impromptu news conference to just pull the cameras away. But talk about this woman's significance.
Well, when I saw her significance and the significance of the MFDP, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which helped to organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, along with Ella Baker and others. When I saw the clip of the uncommitted delegation holding hands, coming in as outsiders inside, coming into the convention hall, asking for such a basic recognition of their dignity, I thought of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation. Of course, black people had been disenfranchised in Mississippi and much of the South since Reconstruction. Fannie Lou Hamer has a special place in my heart, not just as a historian, but she came from the same county in Mississippi, was born in the same year as my mother, who also worked as a sharecropper and domestic worker. So I think of Fannie Lou Hamer as very much of my mother's generation, but also many common experiences. So Fannie Lou Hamer, met young people organizing around voter registration, in the 60s, and they tell the story in SNCC of her looking down the road, and they're coming in their coveralls with their, clipboards, trying to register black voters. And she said she had waited all her life to see them come up that road, because she was, her famous quote is, sick and tired of being sick and tired. And so Fannie Lou Hamer, in some ways, became the heart of SNCC, and of course the heart of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. The thing I like to say about her too, she's often discussed in this sort of folksy way. She sang, she was a religious woman, very powerful voice, and told her story in a most compelling and powerful way, right? Which is why Lyndon Johnson didn't want people to hear that story. But she also was an intellectual and a strategist. She was an internationalist. When MFDP and SNCC took a position against the war in Vietnam, she supported it. She traveled to Africa with young people in SNCC. So somebody who had an expansive notion of freedom. You might say somebody growing up, one of, many children, I think is 11 or 13 children in her family, she would have a very small or parochial view of the world. I want my freedom. But no, she said, we have to get freedom for everybody. And so when the MFDP went to Atlantic City in 64, they came with this delegation that had held an alternative process of selecting electors because they were excluded from the Mississippi Democratic Party. And they said, look, we're a multiracial group. We represent the people of Mississippi. We want to be seated instead of this racist, segregationist, all-white delegation. And the Democratic Party leaned into pragmatism over principle and said no. And then there was all the behind the scenes, and as I understand it, Kamala's team offered the uncommitted folks a compromise, which would be a private meeting, which was so insulting. And similarly, the MFDP had been offered two seats instead of seating their whole delegation. And Fannie Lou Hamer and others said, no, her line was, we've all come a long way and we're all tired and we're not taking no two seats today.
We're doing an expanded two-hour broadcast of Democracy Now! Today. In our second hour, we'll be joined by an activist, a black Muslim, who is involved in the pro-Palestinian issues of this convention, but also is the grandnephew of a man who worked very closely with Fannie Lou Hamer. So folks should tune in to our other hour of Democracy Now! But before we end, Juan, we began this week with you and Bill Ayers going back to 1968, talking about the protests of the time. And as we begin to wrap up, can you share your thoughts about this week?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that struck me most was the level, as I said, of choreographed mass spectacle of this convention that would be really worthy of Leni Riefenstahl, the famous Nazi Hitler's filmmaker and propagandist, in terms of controlling the narrative that the American people receive of what the Democratic Party is about. We've seen that both the Republican convention and the Democratic convention show the two faces of American capitalism. On the one hand, with the Republicans, you have a party of white supremacist capitalism, of anti-immigrant xenophobia, of patriarchy, and of war on the working class. And now, this past week, we've seen the party of multiracial neoliberal capitalism, a party that seeks a kinder and gentler form of mass deportation and border militarization, and one that is even more aggressive in the imperial policies of the United States than even the Republican Party, if you consider that. And both parties sort of having a disconnect with the rest of the world. I was stunned by all the chants of USA, USA, USA throughout the Democratic Convention, when the reality is that the United States has never been lower in its prestige and never more discredited around the world than it is today, as a result of especially of its the war in Gaza, but of all the attempts at regime change and controlling other countries and forcing other countries to do what it wants. And it reminds me constantly that one person, one vote is a dangerous concept because there's always the possibility that the masses of people will act in ways that the rulers don't want. So the necessity to control the narrative, to control what is the people consider possible is so important to our ruling classes. And that's why they invest so much time and so much effort in this choreographing of spectacle to somehow or other prevent the people from thinking of other possibilities. And so I think that that's what had most impact on me, and also the fact that the social movements have had impact. I think Kamala Harris's choice of Tim Walz was a direct response to the sense among this multiracial neoliberal wing of capitalism that they've got to somehow or other placate the masses of the people and bring the young people back into the fold. And so I think they've attempted to do that. We'll see what happens in the coming weeks. But I think that the choices have never been clearer between the two forms of capitalism. And we'll see what the American people decide in the coming weeks.
Your final thought on that, Barbara Ransby?
I agree. I was nodding and amening as Juan was commenting. Yeah, I mean, two faces of capitalism, because we see, you know, it's very hard to be enthusiastic about this moment in the Democratic Party with Gaza and everything else. And I think the cynicism of this orchestrated consensus at the convention is one example of that.
Well, we're going to ask you to stay for our second hour. We have a lot more that we're going to bring everyone. The historian Barbara Ransby teaches here in Chicago at the University of Illinois. She's going to stay with us. That does it for the first hour of our two-hour broadcast. A very happy birthday to Democracy Now!'s Executive Director, Julie Crosby. We've been hosted this week at CAN-TV, Chicago's public access television and media production facility. that has run Democracy Now! For so many years throughout the greater Chicago area. A very special thanks to our CAN TV crew, Darius Hillman, David Tainer, Jason Bryant, Jeremy Fry, Jim Knightwright, Rocio Santos, Imani Payne, Kenny Nelson, Ellen Voss, David Greenleaf, Lynette Rodriguez, Keith McDonald, Anita Targus, and Marissa Moffett. And special thanks as well to the Democracy Now! Crew here in Chicago, Mike Burke, Renee Fell, Sharif Abdelkadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias, and Dennis Moynihan. Back in New York, Democracy Now! Produced with Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, John Hamilton, and Robbie Karen. Special thanks also to Becca Stelly, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Julie Crosby, our director, and Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now! Here in Chicago.